Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandegrift.
It's Friday, July 19th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. Coming up this morning, the place of race in the Didi case.
A space where the neighbors really are for the birds.
Setting the pace to snap up fresh food.
And 60s jazz in a state of grace.
Deutsche Welle has today's worldview. We've got True Colors in the backyard and big metal bird brains coming to a neighborhood near you.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandegrift.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. This conversation may make you uncomfortable. Few of us want to look in the mirror and see prejudice. Most of us don't want to see it in our legal system either. But it's there, and not just in the Martin or Didi cases. UH law professor Justin Levinson says there's an implicit racial bias across the law. That's the title of the book he recently edited. He joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So why is this true?
Well, I think it's a broad question, but if you look at the role of race in society and how our minds actually work, you uncover a whole world of detail that's not typically in the modern narrative and not typically in our own awareness of how our mind actually functions. So when that goes into the law, into criminal law, other areas, you have to look a little bit closer to see how things actually work.
You're really saying that because we are the way we are, we can't but help put this into the laws that we craft?
Right. I'm saying we are largely unaware of many of our own biases. And because of that, what happens is the laws are crafted in certain ways, the laws are applied in certain ways, the laws are interpreted by jurors in certain ways. And those are the things that we ought to start looking at.
Let's talk about some of those things that we're unaware of. What's first on your list?
Our own racial biases, really. Of course, gender plays a role in this too, but today the topic is race. So, for example, if you ask people to self-report their racial attitudes, you won't find too many people who are willing to report anything other than egalitarian views. But when you use modern tests to understand what's actually going on in our minds, what you find is that people have a hard time being egalitarian, thinking in an egalitarian way.
You've seen this in some of the studies about the way in which we regard the value of life of victims' race versus that of a perpetrator. How does this play into the cases that we've just seen, the Martin case just closed and with the Didi case still ongoing?
Yeah, this is a fascinating element of the current cases we're looking at, but actually it's a historical phenomenon that we're not talking about that much. The statistics show over decades that what really tends to matter the most in, at least in death penalty cases, and we can expand upon that, but at least in those cases, what really matters is the race of the victim, not the race of the defendant or the perpetrator. So in cases across the country, study after study has confirmed that if a defendant kills a black victim compared to a white victim, or let's flip it around, if a defendant kills a white victim, they are four times more likely to get the death penalty, even in the same analogous factual circumstances. So the question becomes, how does this happen? What does this mean about our society? And why is it that the race of the victim is what actually matters the most?
We didn't see that necessarily happen in the Martin case, though.
Well, was it
the inverse of that?
Right. So the question in the Martin case is, what's the race of the victim? How do people empathize with him? How do people automatically perceive the value of his life? I actually conducted a study in Florida last year where I tested how people implicitly perceived the value of white versus black lives. And What the study confirmed, which was not a surprise to the research team, was that people actually implicitly associated white lives with value and black lives with lack of worth.
Doesn't that split along racial lines, though?
Well, if you break it down on racial lines, it gets a little bit more complicated. So if you ask the black community that question, you're not going to get the same strong results as if you ask the white community. But if you look at the majority of who ends up on these juries, right, the Zimmerman jury included, you find that members of the black community are largely underrepresented on death penalty juries.
The fact that they don't sync with those people who would be judging you, the jury of your peers idea, clearly what you're saying is these are not peers, they're other, trying to make some assessments, whether they know it or not, based on their own prejudices that they may or may not acknowledge. What does this mean for the way we select juries?
Well, I'm not sure that jury selection itself is going to be the only way out of this. I mean, I am a fan of the jury system. I think that our jury system is one of the wonderful things about our democracy and our legal system, but we have to open our eyes and try to do a better job. Interestingly, jury selection, it's of course unconstitutional to exclude jurors based upon their group membership, such as race, religion, gender. But what research does show is that the more diverse the jury is, the better the decision making. So diverse juries tend to show that they talk more about the facts of the case. They correct each other more often, right? They get into better detail. So I think as a societal goal, we want to make sure that the diversity that's in our society is reflected on juries. And sometimes that's not happening through jury selection processes.
With the Didi case and the fact that here we are in Hawaii and we think we're pretty diverse, we think that we represent so many different groups so well, we're so intermingled. Is it possible for fairness to happen here?
Yeah, I think we have to start with the assumption that we're going to achieve fairness in any individual case. I prefer to look at this on a larger scale and say, when you add up cases in the aggregate, how many times are we going wrong? And when we look at what's happening in the criminal justice system across the country and in Hawaii included, you see a disproportionate number of members of certain groups getting incarcerated and for longer periods of time. So I think it's hard to look at one particular case and say, well, this case won't have justice because of race. But when you aggregate cases, you can see that trend.
We clearly see that those of color are disproportionately represented in prison. This supports a lot of what you've just been talking about. This is going to be a very, very long transition. We thought that we were moving in a better direction. If you were to talk to people who were fighting against a lot of this in the 60s, what hope do you hold out that somehow we'll be able to look ourselves clearly in the mirror, see some of those prejudices, or acknowledge that perhaps they may be there and we don't know it, and do something better especially with our judicial system?
Right. Well, I would first say that, of course, there has been progress, right? That the instances of overt racism have dropped considerably. Now, that to me, that's just the first step in the process. If we can look inwardly in a critical way and think about the fact that we have these biases that are documented over and over by social scientists, we have to ask the question, what does this mean about our society that this is happening, right? What does it mean about our culture? And how do we collectively think about our system, our culture, in a way that reflects the reality that these biases are being passed on from generation to generation?
Doesn't that first mean we've got to take a good hard look at ourselves?
Indeed it does.
All right. Well, thanks very much for coming in, Justin. We need to have a longer conversation. Will you come back?
I will. Thanks
okay,
for having
good.
Me.
Good. Justin Levinson is professor of law and founding director of the Culture and Jury Project at the University of Hawaii's William S. Richardson School of Law. Professor Levinson's research focuses on how the human mind operates in the legal context, including jury selection, decision-making, and biases. He's the editor of the book, Implicit Racial Bias Across the Law.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until they're no longer first class and second class citizens.
This is The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Later in the show, Where the Birds Are, a bird's eye view keeps an eye on you, and now a less serious look at color.
In the backyard today, we consider the long-gone days where communities would pick sides and don the right colors for Friday night football games at the old Honolulu Stadium. The Interscholastic League of Honolulu functioned differently in those days and made possible juicy rivalries between public and private schools. All of Kalihi would come out to support either the Govs or Warriors, and in Makiki and Manoa, which side of Nehoa Street you lived on could define the school to get your cheer. The competition landscape changed, though, when the ILH was restructured and the exodus of Farrington, Kaimuki, Kalani, McKinley, and Roosevelt from the ILH marked the end of the golden age of high school football. Now ILH and Oahu Interscholastic Association matchups don't usually occur until the postseason. For today's backyard quiz, can you name the year those five public school teams left the league? We'll run a few plays and meet you in the end zone in 20 minutes.
Aloha. Good morning. My name is Lillian Cunningham, retired English teacher from Windward Community College, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Now from the bright lights of the gridiron to a darker, quieter neighborhood where some of the residents need ongoing protection. In East Honolulu's Tony Black Point, a colony of wedge-tailed shearwater birds nests on a one-acre lot bordered by luxury homes. The birds are fascinating to study and are even a target of some controversy. Dr. David Harenbach is an assistant professor of oceanography at Hawaii Pacific University who's chronicled the colony, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
This is quite a fascinating little group of birds, about 200, do you say? Nesting colony?
Yes. The last count we completed on Bastille Day, July 14th, yielded 201 nests, which is the highest in the last 5 years.
Well, 201 nests, so yes. Even more. And are they only there part of the year, is that right, during a mating season?
Yes, that's right. They come about end of March, they prospect, find back their mates and their homes, and then they lay their eggs, which hatch about beginning of August, and the chicks will be fed by the parents all the way till the end of November.
At which time what happens?
At that time, the parents say bye-bye, they go to sea, and the chicks, these really chubby, overweight chicks, sit there wondering when the next meal comes, and as the next meal doesn't come, eventually some innate feeling triggers their departure to sea. And then they disappear for 4 to 6 years until they eventually return to themselves, start breeding.
Disappear for 4 to 6 years?
Yes, well, they're out at sea. And, you know, right now we don't have the means to really track such long period of dispersal. Uh-huh. We put metal bands on them the traditional way, like a little license plate on their leg. Uh-huh. And then if we encounter the individual, we'll be able to know where and when this bird was tagged. But really, this is a mystery where they go before they return to the colony.
It's amazing to me, David, that a bird that is under essentially close observation is still going to be so mysterious as to how it spends a large chunk of its life, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. You know, and we have made great inroads with the technology whereby now we can equip the parent birds with different devices to understand how deep they dive, how much time they fly versus sit on the water, even where they go with miniature GPS tags. But this research is really starting now on this particular species, the wedge-tailed shearwater.
And their means of feeding themselves is hovering over the open ocean, seeing perhaps a school of fish come to the surface or even below the surface, and diving how deep?
The deepest records we have is 21 meters from a bird that we tagged in Lehua Islet, very close to Kauai. Mm-hmm. The birds from Black Point that we tagged last year, 10 of them went down to about 9 meters, so about 27 feet, 30 feet.
So they can go shooting into the water from the air and in a diving position, so they kind of carve into the water and grab something to eat and make the surface again?
Yeah, what it seems like is they do not plunge like a booby would. You know, the boobies become these arrows that plunge into the water.
That's the image that I had, yeah.
Yes, no, the wedge-tailed shearwaters do not do this. The petrels, they will land on the water. They'll stick their head underwater to scope, look for things. And then they actually use their legs to kick. They do not flap their wings underwater.
This is more the way a duck might dive.
Yes, yes. And I think the key thing to realize here is that because they're not very good divers, they rely on other marine organisms, tunas and marine mammals, mm-hmm. dolphins, to bring the food close to the surface. Mm-hmm. Flying fish and flying squid are brought close to the surface where they're really accessible for shearwaters and other surface foraging petrels.
And flying fish and flying squid, generally, when we see them flying, when they see them breach the surface of the ocean, they're fleeing from predators, right? Is that usually when we see them?
Yes, that's right. You often will notice if you are an open ocean sailor, oftentimes the bow of the ship will scare off the flying fish and flying squid.
Yeah.
Other times, you know, often you can assume there is a predator underneath that has flushed them into the air to try to escape this predator.
They do it for a reason, in other words.
That's right, yes, yes. The idea is when they jump out of into the air, the different density at the air-water interface makes them invisible because light bends, and there's basically an angle whereby they are not visible from below.
From below. And much to their unpleasant surprise, they might get grabbed by one of these soaring birds.
That's right?
Right,
yes. So in a way, you know, if the birds have cued on to the subsurface predators and, you know, what is happening mm-hmm. in this potential feeding situation, the poor flying fish jumps from the pan into the fire because, you know, a booby or a shearwater will get it on the way out of the water.
You think you're getting away and you're getting grabbed from above.
Yes. We joke that flying fish must really feel very paranoid because they're sort of like the French fry of the sea. You know, everybody eats them, and they must be very, very paranoid.
Well, I never really thought of it that way, but it's certainly hard to think of it any other way now, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, they have huge eyes, you know, and they're twitchy. You know, if you go sailing offshore, you'll see many times your bow scaring off large amounts of them.
Well, you'd be twitchy too, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The life of these migratory birds and their shearwaters have a range of what in their flight?
Well, this particular species, from work done in the past by Aaron Hepshi from UH, we believe they have about 100-kilometer radius when they have chicks at the nest.
Uh-huh.
So this is really...
And then they're bringing food back, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right. They bring food back, and then, you know, they regurgitate this oily, black, squiddy slurry to the chicks, which, you know, they love. That's a way, basically, that they return, you know, high density energy back to their chicks.
Well, it's an ongoing study because there's much still to learn, David, and it's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, we have lots to learn, and I could spend days talking about it.
So it'll keep you busy. That's great.
Yeah, definitely.
Dr. David Hardback is an assistant professor of oceanography at Hawaii Pacific University, and he'll give a public talk next Wednesday about the Black Point colony of wedge-tailed shearwater birds. And you can get details and see photos of the birds on hpr2.org.
Did you know that certain volcanoes scream before they erupt? And that scientists are recording Puerto Rican wetlands with iPods? I'm Ira Plato. Join me on Science Friday for the sounds of science and what we can learn from them. Plus a new moon for Neptune. What should we name it? That's on Science Friday from NPR.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Hawaii Public Radio listeners who are also station members are truly partners in this independent, locally operated enterprise. We gratefully acknowledge Noel and Chelsea Kent of Honolulu, Doug Johnson of Kamuela, and Susan Ishikawa and John Black of Honolulu for their recent membership gifts. New members most often join at the $10 a month True Believer level. As more listeners become members, the station grows even stronger. Become an HPR member today at hpr2.org. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. It's 8:24. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Support for today's programming comes from Diamond Head Theater. On stage next is Legally Blonde, the musical, opening tonight. Tickets and information at diamondheadtheater.com.
Earlier in the show, we talked about endangered birds. Now a look at a metal bird some would like to put in danger, drones. President Obama has defended his extensive use of drones to target terrorists, and that has upset a lot of people. As you know, drones operate in Hawaii. Civil Beat political reporter Chad Blair joins us with a check of this new reality. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Friday, Beth Ann.
It is a happy Friday for some, but for a lot of people who carry issues every day of the week, it's just another day to take a look at something that bugs them. And in this case, There's a lot to be upset about.
That's right. You know, over 40 states have proposed legislation to regulate the use of domestic drones. Domestic drones, mind you, these are not being used, at least not yet, to target American citizens. But that is one of the concerns. And as you indicated at the top, they are used here. Hawaii has a lot of drone use in the islands. Let me give you two examples, both military. The Army's 25th Infantry Division at Schofield, they're using drones, also called UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, but we'll call them drones here. They're used for tactical intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. The National Guard, the 29th Support Battalion, has also been flying four of these drones for reconnaissance. I want to stress here that they are not carrying weapons and that they are flying only over approved military installations and training areas. They're not going over Manoa Valley or Palolo, or at least I don't think they are.
A couple months ago, we talked with Roe Bailey, the deputy director of the Alaska Center for Unmanned Aircraft Systems Integration. What a mouthful. But her point is that, you know, should they actually become the group to lead the proposed test site work that will be done here, that, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about this, that they've done this in many places and really trying to allay some fears, but really stressing that for domestic drone use, we're talking about a helpmate, not something that we should fear. And yet that doesn't wash with a lot of people who feel that somehow this is going to be spying on them too, not just out there to take a look at what ship might be in trouble or take a look at a pod of whales or be able to see if there's you know, some sort of natural disaster that would better be looked at without human eyes, just sending in a drone.
Right. These are ethical concerns, privacy concerns. I mean, can you spy on your neighbor? Can you spy on your ex-wife? What exactly is being gathered in terms of information? There have been protests locally. I know that you're familiar with folks like Jim Albertini over on the Big Island and right here on Oahu. Mm. They have protested drone use at Poakuloa and at Wheeler and so forth. But UH Manoa is looking at research projects with drones. NOAA has been using them. So this is something that we will be taking on, hence the reason to have possibly regulating legislation.
And the bottom line, drones are here to stay?
Yes, they are.
All right. Well, I suppose we will be staying here too, and we'll talk to you next week. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Beth Ann. Look forward to it.
Thanks, Chad. Chad is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Support for The Conversation comes from the First Unitarian Church of Honolulu, proud to support ACLU Hawaii, unitariansofhi.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2, Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Chris Vandercook. This half hour, making farm fresh food a snap for families in need. And we go back to the 1960s bossa nova boom.
What's happening right here at home? Well, we've got Bill Dorman to tell us what the news department's taking a look at, given the rest of us next week. And we're going to start with a little, what, summer Shakespeare? That's apropos.
Shakespeare, it's the season, you know. Shakespeare's always in season, but summer does bring out the local Shakespeare Festival, and this year the first production is one that's not staged all that often, Troilus and Cressida. It's a little heavy. But it's also, it's interesting. You're not quite sure what to make of some of the situations, and it questions sort of what is really important in life. It's one of the reasons that some critics call it one of Shakespeare's more modern plays. And it also, for the company, it lays down a marker of sorts. It starts a season of three plays, and at the end of that, they will have completed the entire canon of Shakespeare plays. So this is it's a marker for them, and it's a real accomplishment. And Noe Tanigawa is going to have a preview of how that's all looking.
How about some real-life drama?
Portrait of a Different Kind, Slice of Life in Hawaii, Free Diving Spear Fishing. Now, up on the North Shore, Kimmy Werner, she grew up on Maui, lives on the North Shore now. I'm going to go out with her for a look at sort of ocean to plate. You know, you talk about farm to table. Get a little up close and personal about the spearfishing experience. More than a sport, a lifestyle. And she's embraced it. She says it's given her a lot of thoughts about sustainability, connection to the ocean. You know, malama o ke kai, ke kai o ke malama, you know, take care of the ocean will take care of you. And so Molly Solomon's going out with her for sort of a full day for that fish to plate, ocean to plate experience. And a little bit more environmental awareness of a different kind. You know, one of the many groups in the state working on smarter transportation solutions, the Hawaii Center for Advanced Transportation Technologies. They do a lot of research in electric vehicles, fuel cells, things like that. Now they're looking at a car that runs on hydrogen. And we're going to take a closer look at where they are in that process. And Wayne Yoshioka is going to go for a little drive on that. So we'll see how that goes as well.
Oh, to be a passenger in that vehicle.
Well, we'll hear all about it. You know, Wayne's a big car guy, so it'll be an interesting perspective on how he feels about the power that you're able to do with a hydrogen car.
Well, he's got a pretty powerful car to compare it to, doesn't
That's
he?
That's true. Little Camaro.
All right. Thanks very much, Bill. Have a good weekend. Bill Dorman is the news director for Hawaii Public Radio. You never know who you're going to meet if you put yourself in a place with like-minded people. My grandmother gave me that advice, and perhaps Kashahoe heard something similar. The community organizer met the co-founders of Green Wheel Food Hub during the Kano Hawaii Eat Local Challenge. Now she's Green Wheel's communications director. These days she's talking a lot about value-added projects and products to help farmers help families in need of good food purchased with what used to be called food stamps. Kashahoe joins us now. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
We are just at the start of a four-day celebration, a preservation celebration, and what's being preserved this time is food and the ability to take surplus and turn it into something real that has value for people who need it.
Yep, that's absolutely right. We're calling our four-day celebration Preservation Celebration. It's really looking at preserving Hawaii's local food system. So at Green Wheel Food Hub, our mission is to increase access to locally grown foods, especially for low-income communities, for everyone living in Hawaii. So the social arm of our efforts is accepting SNAP benefits, the program formerly known as food stamps, at local farmers markets. So that's something that we're doing here on Oahu at the Blaisdell Farmers Market on Wednesdays and at the Wahiawa Farmers Market on Thursdays. And then we're going to be expanding into three additional markets by the end of this year.
And that all came from the first farmers market last year in Mililani, right?
That's right.
Where people could come in and actually use SNAP and their EBT cards for the first time.
Exactly. As you mentioned, Green Wheel Food Hub and Kanu Hawaii partnered together with EAH Housing in a community, Kalani Gardens in Mililani, and we popped up a farmers market right there in the parking lot of the housing complex, and we brought in local farmers, had residents have an opportunity to talk with them, and then residents could actually swipe their EBT card and use that money to buy straight from local farmers, which up until then has been really limited on the places where you can actually use your SNAP benefits to buy locally grown produce and support the local economy, support local farming families at the same time. What's really interesting that I found out in the process of starting up this program is that $33 million come into Hawaii every single month through the SNAP program. So if we can channel even just $1 out of every 100 of those dollars toward local farming families, that would be $330,000 every month, which would actually make a huge difference for local farmers, for our local economy, and it would be an investment in our local food sustainability here in Hawaii.
All that said, it's also poking the argument in the eye about, well, you can't get really good food if you have to use food stamps or
exactly.
Now the EBT or what we now call SNAP to be able to get it, and that's also tied back into the issue of obesity and really teaching what good eating habits are all about. If you don't have access to it, it's kind of meaningless to tell people to go buy good fresh food and have fruits and vegetables, no matter how many of them a day, if you can't get it.
Exactly. And that's really what we're looking at in this project is the opportunity to provide low-income families, families who are going through a tough time in between jobs or whatever is happening circumstantially, with the opportunity to have the absolute best, freshest, locally grown foods, and not just canned foods that you might be able to find at the food bank, not just convenience store foods that you might be able to swipe your EBT card at the 7-Eleven on the corner store and pick up, but really looking at absolutely the freshest and best products for everyone.
And on the flip side of this too, with the farmer, because there are so many who just, you can't just keep this stuff. Maybe you could freeze some of it, but generally they have surplus and it's got to get used and turned into something. And you found a way of creating products with value added for perhaps the rest of us that go back into helping support the EBT friendly farmers markets.
Yeah, we're sort of trying to close that loop there. And so we're looking at, in addition to the increasing access for low-income communities, we're also looking at another issue which is of critical importance in the local food system, and that's food waste. So some of the farmers that we talk to at the farmers markets say that maybe up to 40% of the crops that they have end up being surplus, like they just have too many tomatoes at one time to be able to sell at the markets, for instance.
I should be so lucky.
I know. So it ends up being surplus, or it ends up being what they call B-grade produce. So that's like a cucumber, which is perfectly fine, but it's oddly shaped, for instance. So they don't take those things to market. But what you can do with those products is make them into shelf-stable, value-added things. So what we're doing with Green Wheel Food Hub is buying those surplus and B-grade produce from local farmers at a price that they set. And then we go ahead and process that into gourmet products. So anything from,
you're making pickles.
We're making pickles. We're making jams and jellies and sauces and Bloody Mary mix, all kinds of things.
But in general, this is now creating a model for what might be used by other organizations.
That's what we're trying to do.
And trying to spin this out and replicate it across Hawaii.
Exactly. We started this project with a grant from Hawaii Community Foundation's Island Innovation Fund last year. And our commitment was to start up EBT access at 5 farmers markets and really just look at that system, try to prove the value to farmers markets so that we can sort of kickstart farmers markets accepting SNAP benefits. So looking at, does it increase your customer base? Does it increase farmers' profits? Is it worthwhile to set up? Because it is an investment of both time and money on the farmers markets part. And then we're looking at, in addition to that, trying to set up a self-sustaining system so we're not constantly reliant on grant funding. So for instance, unfortunately, we just saw on the island of Kauai that they did also have the EBT food stamps acceptance at their farmers market, but that program ended at the end of last month because the grant money ran out. So what we're trying to do with this project is try to see if we can create a self-sustaining, self-funding mechanism where we sell those jars of jams and jellies and pickles at the farmers markets, and the proceeds go back to run the program.
Which doesn't sound too different from having a nonprofit be supported by a for-profit entity like, you know, the thrift store that supports your church.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of thing, but in a much more chic and macro sort of way that gives a lot of other people access.
Yeah.
We wish you all the best with it.
Thank you. And that's what our events are all about this week. We're at 687 Oahe Street.
And we've got it all on the Facebook page because this goes by really quickly when people are listening to it. So if you want to know all about what's happening with the preservation celebration, we've got it on our website and we've got it on the Facebook page too.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
And we'll see you this weekend.
Great.
Kasha Ho is the Communications Director for Green Wheel Food Hub, a project of Feed the Hunger Foundation. She spent 10 years as a community organizer in social change movements, including with Kano Hawaii, where she met Green Wheel's co-founders during the Eat Local Challenge. Green Wheel Food Hub and Kano Hawaii partnered on their first EBT-focused farmers market pop-up, and from there, the project to increase acceptance of SNAP and EBT took root. More about this weekend's Green Wheel Food Hub events, as we just mentioned, is on the website, hpr2.org.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable. If you brought a big brown bag of them home, I'd jump up and down and hope you'd toss me a carrot. I'm gonna keep well my vegetables, cart off and sell my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
And now from green food to a buff and blue bell tower. Many Makiki residents still remember Roosevelt High School's changed colors in the wake of a matchup with Punahou. And up in Manoa, neighbors could wake to find Punahou School's Pauahi Dome painted bright red and gold. It used to be a tradition, but as with many others, it's now long gone. That school rivalry fizzled with the restructuring of the Interscholastic League of Honolulu, or ILH. The decision made amid concerns with aggressive recruiting efforts and retention of students by some league schools. The ILH hoped to create a more equal footing among teams, and so 5 public schools made an exit. And today we asked you for the year they left the ILH. Farrington, Kaimuki, Kalani, McKinley, and Roosevelt all said goodbye in 1970 when they joined the Oahu Interscholastic League. And that's today's backyard quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Van Jones from Rebuild the Dream. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
While we're still looking back at good days long gone, here's a case of good music that's just as sublime as when it seduced a generation at the dawn of the 1960s. Jazz had come to a crossroads. It had always been guided by the need to make it new, and a lot had already been done. Jazz needed an infusion of new ideas and approaches, and they came in large part from Latin America. Singer Allison Adams Tucker will put the focus on a time of change in jazz and on the changes that have come about since in a concert tomorrow night in our Atherton studio. And she joins us on the phone. Good morning, Allison. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It was, it was an interesting time in jazz, the 1960s, because a lot of the existing styles up to then, and this is just my perspective, but they had kind of peaked. And there was a...
Yes.
I remember a drive to do something new that led us in all kinds of different directions, not all of them all that musical. But when the Brazilian guys came along, Jobim and Bonfa and, the composers, Gilberto...
Yes.
It really was kind of a breath of fresh air, wasn't it?
Well, and I only know it from, the recordings and from what I've read and researched, but I certainly remember as a kid, all of the way that I first came across Bossa Nova was literally in the elevators and on the escalators.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't really appreciate it for what it was at that time. I associated it with certain things in my childhood. But then as I got older and reevaluated and started really listening to the music of the 60s and understood how it impacted the music that was already in place here in the States and worldwide, I just fell deeply in love with it.
Well, in the jazz world, we had standards, which came, in large part from things like Broadway shows, popular songs adapted to jazz, right? And they tended to have their musical patterns and lyrical patterns. And then you had so-called jazz tunes, Monk and Mingus, and things written specifically for jazz, going all the way back to, say, to Ellington. But then, but that was all kind of in place. And the
Brazilian rhythms were in place as well. However, just not in the Northern Hemisphere.
Exactly.
And so when they collided, it was something spectacular that... And of course, you bring any Brazilian rhythms up to another culture, and they're going to take on some of the existing things that were already in place that you were speaking of.
Sure.
And kind of fuse together. So that's the magic of it, I think.
Well, and of course, Girl from Ipanema was a huge hit on the radio, and it kind of merged the jazz saxophone with that very breathy Astro Gilberto vocal.
Exactly.
And we hadn't heard that before, had we?
Yeah, and specifically the jazz voice in the 1960s. We're speaking kind of the form of jazz and music in general, but the jazz voice of the 60s, I really feel, made a transition. You had the big band era in all of its glory, 30s, 40s, 50s, and it started waning in the 60s, and all of those great jazz singers, Ella and Dinah Washington and Sarah Vaughan and Betty Carter, had to find their footing for the change that was taking place. And a lot of them embraced the Latin music that was filtering in. Doris Day did Latin for Lovers, and Betty Carter included a lot of Latin numbers, Ella as well. And they had to go smaller, than from big band down to, the trio.
Sure.
Betty and Ray Charles did, their duo album. And she ended up having to open up her own label, even in the late 60s.
Well, and she was
going.
And she was very much Betty Carter, was very much a pioneer in sort of getting her music out there without compromise,
One of the first independent artists, indie artists, as we might call them today.
Yeah. Well,
successful at it.
One of the things that I hear in somebody like Betty Carter, Allison, is the use of the voice in the same way that a musical instrument might be used in jazz, correct?
Exactly. Correct. I couldn't agree with you more. And a big inspiration to me in that way, because I've always been very lyric-based, melody and lyric, but very in tune with the words, because I'm a linguist and I really connect with words. Mm-hmm. However, people like Betty Carter have really made me go inward and think of what can I do with my voice that has nothing to do with words whatsoever, that is more like other instruments. And
well, you know, Allison, this morning I listened to a recording. I think it was your version of Blue Skies, where you start out with a wordless scat vocal before the rhythm section comes in. Is that the one I'm thinking of for you?
Yes, it is. And it was inspired by Ella's version, different chord changes and whatnot, but she did something similar, and I wanted to get that feel going.
Well, what happens in that case, at least to my ears, are that the scatting, the improvisation, and the actual singing of the lyrics, they complement each other, and that seemed to me what you were striving for.
Exactly. I think that our human ears, the listener and his human ears, can kind of desensitize when we hear too much of one thing, mm-hmm. whether it be words or too much scatting or too much, playing out, avant-garde, or too much of a very, playing in time. We need constant diversity to keep our minds intrigued. And what is music for but to intrigue the mind and the soul and to make us feel good?
Well, is a challenge for jazz musicians who are sort of trying to use a piece of music as a point of departure to, put in some of their own message, from getting too far away from what's familiar. Do you run into that?
Oh, boy. I do. What kind of examples are you thinking of specifically?
Well, I'm thinking of a club owner who once complained to me, you guys need to play music people can understand. And we understood it, you know what I mean?
Exactly. And I'm sure there were others in it. Listening audience that understood it as well.
I hope so.
I think I don't run into it as much simply because I come from such a classical background with my music. I came from so many other genres, pop and R&B and classical and gospel. That going into jazz and learning to free myself for improv and to think outside the box was an exercise every day. I'm just now exploring going out enough where people would ask me to do something that was a little more grounded,
Well, but it's an exploration that never ends, Allison, and it's great to talk to you this morning. We look forward to tomorrow night.
Likewise, and I can't wait to have you as MC as well.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Allison Adams Tucker will perform Jazz Voice of the 1960s, the Bossa Nova Boom, Betty Carter, Brubeck, and Beyond, tomorrow night at 7:30 in Hawaii Public Radio's Atherton Studio. You can learn more from our HPR2.org website.
E a vontade de cantar seu tal azul, ilhaço sul e o barquinho coração deslizando na canção. Tudo isso é paz, tudo isso traz uma calma de verão. E então o barquinho vai, a tardinha cai.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providers of auto, commercial, and specialty lines of insurance since 1911. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
Hoku Award winner Nathan Avell, ukulele master Benny Chong, and classical guitarist Ben Verdery join Jeff Peterson in the Palikū Theater on Sunday, August 4th at 4 p.m. Enjoy an afternoon of slack key, jazz, and classical music, plus new songs inspired by Jeff's recent trip to South America. Make your reservations at hawaiipublicradio.org and click on events or call 955-8821 during business hours.
Bethann, the President Obama just made a statement not within the hour about the Trayvon Martin case, and without talking specifically about the way the case was adjudicated, he just made some comments about being African American in this country, you know, saying that like I among many have been followed while walking in a department store, Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. I'm just hoping that this is a discussion that is beginning and maybe is going to move to a different level.
And you bring this up because this morning we started the hour talking with Justin Levinson about a book he just edited called Implicit Racial Bias Across the Law, and the fact that so many of us are unaware of our own biases and we think we're acting in a certain way, but really it's coming from someplace else. And he has a lot of studies that he used to talk about this. You know, when the president said, if Trayvon Martin was of age and was armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we think he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems we need to rethink stand your ground laws. I mean, he's pointing clearly at race having an issue in who should have stood the ground and what we would have thought about that person based upon race only.
And he's not making he's deliberately not making a judgment about the way that particular case was adjudicated, but simply talking about the whole national discussion of these kinds of statutes.
Exactly. And we're going to have a bigger conversation about this as we go forward, obviously. But we were not going to do it right now because we have to say goodbye to you. That does it for this week. But coming up on Monday, we're going to talk with the author of The Open Letter to the People of Hawaii and president of IndependentVoting.org about Hawaii's Democratic Party's lawsuit.
And the power and passion of the Portuguese musical heritage.
Let us in on your radio talkback. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Maddie DeShazo is our production assistant. And today we say goodbye to interns Andy Walters and Alex Ellenberg. Ryan Suahisa will bravely soldier on as our remaining summer intern.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello.
I'll be away next week. Lynn Waters will be here.
And we hope you will be too. I'm Chris Vanner.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. Come back on Monday and pick up the conversation.